Lovely afternoon. And so when we look at the, say, the development of the path, the development of meditation, as all many of you are well aware, there's many, many different kinds of techniques that you can use to get some stability, some tranquility of mind. And so as the vast majority of you are aware, you have two major signs of the path. You have the, say, the peaceful, calming, tranquility side, and then you have the active investigation, wisdom, vipassana based side of the practice. So when you look at the, say, the bare bones of the meditation practice, you're looking at those two major categories. But naturally, you know, you've got the overall scheme, you know, with the 37 enlightenment factors, which overrule the whole system of training that the Buddha laid down. And so in a nutshell, you know, those two sides of the practice, you actually have to pay reasonably quite close attention to get, say, good results over time, because, you know, with every single one of you, meditation, it's a wisdom-based practice. Even though the vast majority of you may just want to get peaceful, contented, happy, when you've got that level of peace and calm and tranquility, you know, you have to make the mind work. You know, you have to develop your insight, your understanding of oneself and the world around you, because the whole experience of the path will be one of, say, like polarities, in a sense, you know, happiness, pain, you know, peacefulness, proliferation of mind, you know, all the opposites you can possibly think of in relation to human experience. You know, you're going to experience that with the practice, and to be successful in meditation, you have to actually watch over. It's like you're the parent of a child. You know, your mind, you know, you come into this world, into this human birth, and you're not, the vast majority of us are not born with a wisdom faculty. You know, you have to develop that, you know, actively within yourself. You know, every single one of us, we have our spiritual parami as you move from life to life, but the vast majority of the time, you know, you get that through, one's own efforts. You know, you're not born with wisdom. You're not born with incredible personality traits and kindness, compassion, you know, tolerance. These things you have to develop over time. And if you see any human being, any child who really stands out on, say, like an interpersonal level, has very, very, you know, good qualities, even at the age of a 6-7 year old, you know, you can see that this child is different from others, and has, you know, quite sort of outstanding, say, personal characteristics for a very, very young person. That individual, regardless of the age, they've developed that over time. You know, you just, in this universe, you don't get something for nothing. You know, you have to work for it. You have to develop it. Develop one's personal skills and polish one's character over time. So if you see anyone with outstanding meditation, you know, and an outstanding ability to communicate with others, you know, that person, you know, they've developed that over time. It's a personal a skill that could have taken easily one or two lifetimes to develop. So, but the whole business with the meditation practice, that no matter what you do, because when it comes to practicing of Dhamma, there's many ways and approaches to Dhamma, many ways and approaches to meditation. And if you look at the Samadhi side of the practice, if whatever you do gets you peaceful, even if you had, say, for example, visualization of little kittens, and then you got incredibly tranquil and peaceful, you know, that's something which would be, you know, like, say, like a skillful means for you, something which would, you know, be quite sort of useful, regardless of how unusual it might be. So whatever approach you use, the more peaceful it gets, the more peaceful it gets you, it's something you should, you know, you should develop, say, within oneself. And the same with the insight practice. Whatever gives you that ability to unravel and unlock problems and difficulties, and you know, come to an understanding, a deepening of intuition of oneself and others. You know, the ability to say smooth over the ups and downs of life. You know, developing emotional stability, the ability to get along with others. The ability to problem solve, the ability to connect with the right people. I mean, there was one young lady. There's a couple who came upstairs at the monastery, and she wanted to be blessed in order to sort of like meet the right people in life. But that's something that you do, you know, these things, there may be a degree of karma in that, you know, a karma can actually cause you to cross paths with people who are good for you, who are pleasant in nature, who become lifelong friends, you know, very, say, good human relationships. These things are quite possible karmically, but, you know, with the vast majority of us, it's something you have to actively develop. You know, if you want to meet the right people in life, it's just, you know, like, if you want to marry the right person in life, it's something you actively do. Or this is a certain, like, area of employment skills and training that you're interested in. It's something you actually have to actively move towards and develop. So in essence, that you know, every single one of us, you know, you have to teach yourself to a degree. You know, for example, the lay teachers and the monastics can give you a degree of, knowledge, understanding, you know, sort of like an intuitive, say, feel for practice, for Dhamma, you know, this kind of thing, you know, because you know, if you've been practicing for, you know, say at least 10, 20, 30 years, you know, you should have a really good feel for Dhamma practice, you know, how to live one's life, you know, successfully, or, you know, reasonably successfully, because our human life is just so complicated, that, you know, just to have a reasonably good quality life is quite a sort of like a blessing, in a sense, when you consider just the amount of stuff that you have to deal with family, with work, personal relationships. You know, it could be anything. You know, caring for others, one's aging, you know, mum and dad, and, you know, just all the complexities that life throws at you. So what I'll do with this particular meditation session, we'll do like a three-in-one component, and I want you to get a feel for this emptiness principle, which I've been probably doing, say, for about the last 7 days or so, just to see where it would take me. And so all of you are aware that, you know, the Buddha taught the contemplation of changeability, unsatisfactoriness, and the emptiness of personal phenomena within oneself, within the nature of this universe. And so, what, you know, what's the purpose of that? I mean, why would I even bother? Why would I even bring that up? Say, for example, in the class format. And what happens is, it's something. It's like all Dhamma principles. You develop it and you get a feel for it. How far it will take you. What it can, its characteristics. What will it actually do? The effect on your character, your personality. So with that emptiness principle, when you really start to generate that, say for example with the lay practitioners, if you, every time you did like your meditation practice, if you took a particular theme, it could be say moods, it could be consciousness, it could be perception, it could be say dhammas, it could be the universe, absolutely, it could be a thousand and one things, and that particular say area of study is empty in nature, say, like, could be something like, say, perception, is empty in nature. So they have those three syllables, consciousness is empty in nature. So as you do the breathing meditation, or as you walk meditation, and you do that this kind of mantra in a very, just very, very relaxed, spacious way, you start to develop that this perception of this attitude towards, say, life. And the one thing I noticed quite early was, you know, you get a level of, say, detachment, a level of emotional stability. And it's almost like it's early days yet. You know, you want to spin this thing for at least a full 30 days to see what it can do. But you get more space between you and your personal experience. So it's almost like neutrality of mind, but you get more emotional stability. You know, the one's feelings and emotions don't get so intense. You know, one doesn't get blown out by people when they do, say, like do crazy things on you. So you know, it's quite useful in the sense you don't become overly detached, where you really don't care less, or you're not concerned whatsoever, because as you develop this emptiness principle, it still makes you aware. You still feel this sensory awareness. You can still feel a sharpness of the senses. So it makes you aware of what's going on around you. You know, sharpen the faculties, which meditation does. So even that principle, even as spacious as that principle does, it has an effect like that. It's got and so as you start to sort of kickstart this one, you see what it can do over time. So what I want you to do is, for 5 minutes, I want you to choose the most difficult person that you can imagine, someone who's just a complete nightmare, and you don't love or cherish at all in any way. So, you know, so just imagine maybe your boss or the most difficult person in your life at present. And so if that person's name is, say, Anthony, you know, like Anthony is empty in nature. So that, as we you can do it by itself, or you can do it with a breathing meditation. Just make sure it's nice and comfortable in a way which suits you. As you're breathing out, say Anthony, and then breathing in, breathing out is empty. Breathing in, breathing out in nature. So you get this kind of a more spacious perspective, like a distancing, like a detachment. It's something you can feel. And so either do that mantra alone, or you do it might be easier. We'll just do the mantra alone at this point. I don't want to confuse you too much. And so with the beginner's instructions, just get yourself in a nice, comfortable position. With the ankles crossed, the hands together, back straight, and have the head upright and comfortable. Make sure you can breathe fully into the chest. You know, there's nothing tight around the wrists, around the waist, around the throat. And just do that mantra. You know, as you say that person's name, you will visualize that person's name. That person will come up in your mind as a visualization. And then watch how you feel about that individual, and then after, you know, in the beginning, and then how you feel about that individual after 5 minutes of this kind of mantra, what would you call it, so recitation. We'll do that for 5 minutes, and then we'll do the darkness, the dark colour meditation with eyes closed, focusing on the dark colour in the mind. And then we'll use the rest of the session for the breathing meditation, focusing around the mouth. So so we'll make a start. So do the that emptiness mantra of the person of your choice for the next 5 minutes, please. As soon as you do the mantra recitation, just try to relax emotionally and physically as much as possible. Now we'll move across to the dark colour meditation. So the vast majority of you've got your eyes closed, so you see that dark neutral colour in the mind with one's eyes closed. And I want you to put your attention on that. And the reason is that, you know, that kind of perception, it draws your attention away. When you focus on that absence of light, that dark colour in the mind with eyes closed, you're drawing attention away from thoughts, from feelings, from the physical body. And it actually works quite well. I've used it previously on many occasions. So just focus on that dark colour, just in a very relaxed way for the next 5 minutes. So if your mind wanders to thinking or events from the past, just at this point, just keep bringing your attention back to that dark colour. Move across to the breathing meditation. So you can either do the breathing meditation by itself, focusing on the, say, the feelings around the mouth section, which gives you a sharp but comfortable focus, which is very, very easy to follow because there's lots of sensations around the mouth area and you can track that very easily. And you can do the emptiness mantra. Actually, it's a good idea if you can do the emptiness mantra with the breathing meditation, so you can get a really good feel for that that emptiness principle, because it's quite a kind of spacious mentality when you develop it. So you choose. You can either do the emptiness mantra with the breathing, focusing around the mouth, or you can just do the breathing meditation by itself for the rest of the session. you feel a bit tired or sleepy with the heat, just make sure you keep breathing deeply. Breathe into the full chest, slowly, deeply. Maximize the amount of oxygen which is reaching your brain. So if you're still thinking a little bit too much, you know, people, memories, views and opinions, just try to come to an understanding of that mind state. So if you're thinking of a particular person, you know, try to understand the emotional dynamics there. You know, people don't think without a cause. They're not attached without a cause. You know, people's attachments are driven by emotion, emotional energy largely. And so when you understand that emotion, you can help to say like unlock and free the mind, because you've got like an insight and understanding of the process. So you know, when you think about certain things, the more you understand yourself on the emotional level, focusing on those feelings, that you can release different things, you know, people, to a degree, experiences, past events more easily, because the insight is established or in place. You know, once mind can understand exactly what's happening and can relinquish things much more easily. suppose the emptiness meditation develops, just see if you can see any increasing, say, spaciousness or detachment in the mind as it continues. So we're coming towards the end of the meditation. So just look at the state of the mind and just see which techniques work for you. So I'll ring the gong 3 times. You can open your eyes when you're ready. Did anyone have any questions on the meditation at all? Anything whatsoever? No? So, from Johnston, USA, does breath meditation indirectly hint impermanence and death? Does the calmness during meditation allow hidden death anxieties to arise? Well, if you say, for example, when you look at people's personal experience, breath meditation will bring up, say, like different insights on different levels. It all depends on your personal makeup, you know, past karma, your current life experience. Will actually like trigger, bring up certain kind of experiences, maybe insights in the past, because as you're developing the meditation and you're keeping yourself in touch with the path. It could be any kind of path. Like we had two young people on the Bindabat this morning. Two young people I hadn't seen previous who were Christian meditators. So even Muslim, Christian, Hindu, and Jewish meditation practitioners or yogis, are going to, could potentially bring up like an understanding, an intuitive awareness, which can relate to their traditional or possibly even others, but. A lot of it depends on people's personal makeup, what actually comes up for you, because if some amazing insight comes up with your daily set of meditation practice that you do, it means there's a cause, there's a basis for that. Nothing comes out of nowhere or nothing. There's got to be a cause, there's got to be an underlying principle. So, does breath meditation interact in permanence and death? So, you will, to give you an idea, one of the forest masters in Thailand, I'm not sure if even the Buddha actually said this categorically, but one of the Thai meditation masters said that the 84th, this is a good one, the 84,000 Dharma doors can potentially arise from the breathing meditation. So if you want to take that breath meditation to its absolute pinnacle, right to its maximum potential, you can say things like that. But if you, for someone to say something like that, you've got to be at that level. It's like what's the word? One can't be sort of too casual and flippant. If you're really talking in a way which implies that you know or understand certain things. You better make sure that you do. You're not trying to basically con people or fool them. So it is. Yeah, I wouldn't deny it. Yep. Significant insights could come up with impermanence and death, but it may come up to a small, a small to middling degree, with basic meditation practice. But if you're talking about, real. Life-changing awareness, intuitive insight. The mind has got to be absolutely still. I mean, no thinking. The mind is absolutely solid, not moving, not thinking. Just one point. One pointedness of mind. And that's when you really, really see what the Buddha was talking about. This is why the Buddha just kept going on and on and on and on about the jhanas in the suttas, and this is exactly the same reason why the forest masters, regardless, male or female, even if there are 8 precepts, but they've got exceptional, outstanding practice in Thailand, Burma, Sri Lanka, wherever, could be Vietnam or China. It's essentially an intuitive thing. It's something you can only know for yourself. But every single one of these people will tell you if in order to get incredibly deep, powerful insight, and eventually progressively to become an enlightened being, you've got to have upachara samadhi. The mind has got to be absolutely still. No thinking whatsoever, and you come out of that state. That state of stillness, really, really deep, powerful tranquility, where the mind is very still, it's very clear, it's very powerful, it's like a laser beam, and when you focus on something, you can see as deeply as a human being can possibly go into the nature of the body and mind and the universe. This is why, you know, if it took a normal level of samadhi to get enlightened, there would be absolutely thousands of people, you know, so like in Western Australia, you know, in capital cities all over the world, who've attained the Dhamma, you know, the four stages of enlightenment. So even though samadhi can slow people down, it affects their memory, it affects their peripheral awareness, it all depends how you practice. You've got to feel it out. You keep contemplating. This is what keeps people aware. It keeps them reasonably sharp, because with most people, samadhi, it does affect. It affects brain speed. It affects memory. It affects thinking. But that's exactly what it's supposed to do. You know. But you adjust the practice in a way which is suitable for your work, for your family life. Could be anything. You know, personal life. If you say, for example, you're a person who's a, it could be someone like who's like a mountain climber, or maybe a policeman, or you could be a high class security person on really really big projects or venues. You've got to be sharp. You've got to be on the ball, and you can't afford to make too many mistakes. So this is where the insight, you know, samadhi is one thing. And insight is another. So you can't get deep insight without deep samadhi. You're looking at both sides. It's like, you know, the two facets of the practice. So does the calmness during meditation allow hidden death anxieties to arise? So that would certainly be a potential for that, depending on the makeup of the individual. So a person who gets really, really blown away by some very, very powerful experiences of death, or maybe insights into death or near-death experiences, which is a more common, which is something which people substantiate when their consciousness leaves their physical body. That has the potential. That level of deep meditation, or even everyday meditation, can do that. But the depth of the insight will only go so far. It's like as you're developing the path. If your samadhi is at this level, you can take your wisdom to the same level or slightly higher, but you can't take it like 200%, 300%. You know, you've got to have samadhi as a basis, but it's something that's tangible. You can feel it. If you're smart, regardless of if you're a short or long-term practitioner, your samadhi is at that level. But with insight, no matter, the more insight you do, the more you gain, because you know you will always take the vipassana, the wisdom, the insight to its highest level. But that investigation in itself promotes the jhana factors. It promotes the five factors for samadhi practice, and it's something that you feel. You know, it's anyone. When you look at your personal character, anyone who struggles with getting peaceful, getting tranquil, you know, naturally, you have people who think too much. They could be quite intellectual, quite intelligent. So the mind is fast, it's active, and they can't stop thinking. So that individual, if the thinking process is excessive, you've got to focus on wisdom. You know, if you think too much, well, put that energy, put that focus on investigation. It can be, you know, even the smallest, most trivial things, like, you know, why is a spoon a certain shape and size? Why are the steps on the stairways in our homes or hotels a certain width, length, and height? It's all in relation with the human body. So, you know, if you have you could have an individual, you could have young monks who or practitioners who feel, well, I don't really have much to contemplate, I don't really feel like I sort of notice things very much in everyday life. But you know, you can look at ants crawling on the ground. To give you an idea, as I was walking out the back there, these two little birds were making a fuss. They were very, very territorial and chirping and carrying on. And I noticed them, and I thought, what are these guys up to? And they kept circling me, and they kept bouncing on the fence, and then on the tree, and then back and forth on the air conditioner and this and that. And I thought, so that's why I kept walking back and forth. I just watched them when they were most active. And as soon as I was under the nest was probably about, I'm only guessing, about whatever, 12, 13 feet up. As soon as I was right under the nest, these guys got really active. And so they're pretty smart. They put the nest right in the fork of three small branches, and they put the nest on the most tranquil part of the tree, the most still part of the tree, even when the wind was blowing, and they put it exactly where one of the local cats couldn't reach it, nowhere near the main stem, near the main trunk, where the cats could basically go straight up and grab the little chicks, or grab mum and dad. But right out on the limb, where no cat could possibly hold its balance. It wouldn't support the weight. So, you know, you see how nature, just in a little thing like that, you know, two little birds with a nest in the tree, you know, you start to see, well, why is the nest right there? Why is the nest a certain shape? Why is that nest made of some kind of clay-based material in that fork of that tree, at that height, at that distance from the trunk? Certain size and shape and whatever. So, you know, even things like that average people may not particularly pay attention to, maybe with the exception of people who are into maybe biology or animal, culture, you know, who've read and studied in that area and who've already got like underlying knowledge. So, say for example, people who have who've done studies in biology will have a greater awareness of biological processes around them in the environment and internally than the average person in the street, because they've got a body of knowledge in that area which makes them aware. It makes them, you know, they notice and see things. I've seen geologists. I've been in company with geologists who've said things in groups. Say, for example, we had a cluster of people, or there was something happening in the monastery, and they would mention things about stone and strata and composition and heat range and underground caverns where these things were basically percolated and the elements were produced at incredibly high temperatures in these cauldrons under the earth, and then eventually being spewed out on a mountain slope, and then you get this kind of limestone quartz formation in the middle of nowhere. The surrounding rock is completely different. And he explained the full process, and it's just amazing stuff, you know, for people who are interested in natural processes. So, you know, things like that, knowledge is power. Knowledge makes you aware, and your inner knowledge will give you the greatest awareness, because it's like what you know and understand can potentially connect with everything, because your mind is at the center of your universe. It's at the center of your being, and when you cultivate your mind, it increases your potential to know and understand many, many things around you. So we've come to the end of the session. If anyone needs to chat, please come up and we'll call it an afternoon, and I'll catch up with you guys later. Mm-hmm.